We tend to focus our lives on the church. We measure each week by the Sabbath, you know. In some cases, we count specifically in our mind to the Sabbath. You know, in the Bible, it's day one, day two, day three, day seven. It's not the days of the week as we so commonly use them. We count the years by the holy days. We look outside and see the full moons, and we count from the moon to the holy days that are approaching. We talk about ABC and YOU and where we went for the feast. And sometimes a person listening in wouldn't really understand what it was that we had just said. They would understand the conversation overall, but not the specifics. We talk for hours about what it is that we did or who it is that we did it with. And that's fine, as long as we keep it in perspective. God says we're to come out of the world. But sometimes we are able to come out of the world so fully that we not only leave the world's values behind, but we leave behind the people as well. God didn't intend us to live our lives in some kind of a spiritual cocoon, tucked away inside the church, safely protected and distanced from all of the world around us. The world's values, yes. The people themselves, absolutely not. If we're the salt of the earth, then we have to function in such a way as to have a savor. If we're the light on the hill, then we have to function in such a way as to be exposed so that that light can even be seen. I want to address some of the issues today that would remind us that, yes, we come out of this world's values, but let's not leave the people behind. John 17 and verse number 15, Jesus Christ praying for the disciples and the fact that they would carry on, that he's about to die. And he very specifically said, I do not pray that you take them out of the world. So come out of the world, but he's not praying to the Father to take the disciples out of the relationships and the example and the associations that were there, but that you should keep them from the evil one. Protect them from Satan. But I'm not praying that you take them out of the world. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. So set them apart. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. But as you sent me into the world, I have also sent them into the world. And that is the only way the light can be seen, is when we are in the world itself. Not by value, but by our example and by our association. And for their sakes I sanctify myself, that they may also be sanctified by the truth. The truth and the way we live the truth is the light. But the light is only seen because we have association in that relationship with those people. Proverbs 18 is very strongly placed, and I want to use it just as an illustration. And I want to apply it in this way in terms of separating ourselves from the people themselves. Proverbs 18 and verse number 1. It says, a man who isolates himself, in this case, by analogy, tucks himself into the spiritual cocoon of the church and keeps and minimizes all other associations so that we can live within our comfort zone and amongst our friends and with all of our church speak. We can speak one to another and understand what we have said. But it says, a man who isolates himself seeks his own desire. It is a selfish act. And he rages against all wise judgment. Christ said, I pray not that you take them out of the world. That is not my prayer. We don't know what the impact of our relationships are going to be, the way we treat people, the people we have contact with, the memories that are going to be there, and the impact that's going to have. We were driving down today, chatting with Terry in the front seat. And he mentioned, you know, he used to live back in 1982 on some property north of Kettle Falls, and there was no water on the property, but it was accessible from a piece adjoining, and through a series of agreements, there became, again, some problems. And in discussing the matter with his attorney at the time, he said, well, you got a choice. You can sue the person who sold the property to you, or you can sue your neighbor for the water itself. And he thought, well, I really don't want to sue anybody, frankly. And in the course of time and his ability to go back into the ministry full-time back then, he lost that property, but he went on with his life. He let the property go and went on in his service to God. 1992, they moved back into that very same area on a totally different piece of property. But it turns out he had the exact same neighbor. Now, what are the odds of that? That you would come back to an area, live in another place, and the neighbor would be the same one you left 10 years before. Pretty remarkable. We never know the impact we're going to have, the example that we're going to set, and the way that is going to be taken. God will use us if we will let Him. But we have to build and maintain relationships outside of the church. We're not to live in this little cocoon where we maintain ourselves by ourselves, for ourselves, in that way. Hebrews 13 is a scripture that I've given reference not too long ago, but I want to go back to it. Hebrews 13 and verse number 1. It says, let brotherly love continue. A brother, we talk about each other as brethren. We're brethren. We're part of a family unit. The church is a family. So it says, let brotherly love continue. But where does that brotherly love extend? It goes beyond the congregation. It goes beyond just us. It says, do not forget to entertain strangers. For by doing so, some have unwittingly entertained angels. Who are the strangers here? I don't feel like a stranger when I go to a different church area. I'm getting ready to go down to Tucson. Last week I was at the home office in Cincinnati. Not too long before that I was in San Antonio. Before that I was in Steamboat Springs for the feast. I'm going places where there are other people that I either know or in some cases have never met, but I don't feel like a stranger at all. I feel quite at home. When you transfer to a feast site halfway around the world, you meet people that you never would have met in this flesh, and you feel right at home. Who are the strangers? I remember going out as a student in Ambassador College, and we were going to the summer camp, and we were traveling up from Texas to Minnesota, and we would call ahead to the minister in a particular city where we would need to go and spend the night, and he would say, fine, I'll let you stay with so-and-so. He would give us a phone number, we'd get directions, and we would go, we would stay in their home, they would feed us dinner, we would fellowship and have a very pleasant time, and I was never a stranger, even with people that previous to that I had never met. Talks about entertaining strangers. I wonder if that doesn't apply maybe to people who are out in the world, who are not in the church, because I frankly have never really felt like a stranger in the body of Christ, no matter where I was. I'm not saying it was limited strictly to that, but it does make me wonder, because in the church I feel at home. If you go back and look at the Greek to entertain strangers, no brighter than I am in my Greek studies, the best I could figure out is that was just a single word. And it means to show hospitality. But the first part of that word is phil, as in Philadelphia, as in brotherly love. And so the word breaks down into actually loving strangers or loving guests, entertaining strangers. It's a word that means to love someone who is sufficiently different from you that they seem to be a stranger when you meet, and yet showing them love. Let brotherly love continue. And that's where that word comes from. Oh, that's what that word means. I think it's an important distinction when we understand that. 1 Timothy 5 is a reference to the example that is set by an individual that includes having this kind of love for someone who is in some way remarkably different from us. 1 Timothy 5, verse number 9. It says, don't let a widow under 60 years old be taken into the number. Now, I don't know exactly what the number was. I'm not sure that it's actually spelled out. We've wondered if it hadn't something to do with special responsibilities or maybe in terms of special needs. Previous to this, it talks about if anyone does not provide for his own, verse 8, especially for those of his household, is denied the faith as worse than an unbeliever. So it does say if anyone has a network of support or a family structure or the ability to maintain themselves, that they should, that they should not be at charges to the church. But it goes on, verse 9. It says, don't let a widow under 60 years old be taken into the number. But it's a reference here to a widow of a particular type of character that in some way would appear provided a particular service within the church. And not unless she's been the wife of one man, well reported of good works, if she has brought up children, if she has lodged strangers. That's a pretty remarkable thing. How many of our widows would we recommend lodge strangers in their home? You know, it didn't say that she had to lodge them after she was a widow. It just said that she had done that in her life. She obviously was the wife of one man before she was a widow. So it reflects simply on a life of character and sacrifice and service. Somebody who loved a stranger, which again, to me, would indicate somebody that was in some way, at least significantly different from who she was as well. If she's washed the saints' feet, kept the Passover faithfully, if she has relieved the afflicted, if she has diligently followed every good work, diligently been willing to give to others, even strangers. I don't think those limits are limited to the church. We do tend to focus our lives on the church. We count the weeks by the Sabbath. We count the years by the holy days. We count our trips and our travels amongst our friends. But we were not to be taken out of this world totally in that way. I think one of the most interesting subjects to some people is the place of safety. Who wants to hear about the place of safety? Okay, an honest response. Petra, as we refer to it. You know, the Bible only says so much. Mr. Swaggity was up here saying how lousy my sermons are sometimes, and he has to sit down and hope that there will be something that I have to say. I remember sitting in Pasadena, and a presentation was going to be made on the place of safety at one of the ministerial conferences. And the man got up and he went through all the scriptures that I had already heard on the place of safety. He made the same speculations that had already been speculated about the place of safety, because the Bible only says so much, and then you got to go fill in the blanks yourself. At some point in time, the only thing fundamentally different is who filled in the blank differently than the person who filled it in before. But we all want to hear about the place of safety. The place of safety, in one fundamental sense, is where the church is all together and separate from the world. And I think we think of that and say, what a wonderful time that's going to be if at least we're all getting along at that time. The world is separate. How much does the way we think about the place of safety, though, overlay our life today, where the church, in that sense, remains separate? How much of an impact is that focus that we have and the desire for that day overlay itself on the way we look at the world around us at this time? Mark chapter 2 and verse 13 is the example of Jesus Christ that was offensive to some. Mark chapter 2, verse 13. He says he went out again by the sea, and all the multitude came to him, and he taught them. As he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax office. And he said to him, follow me. And he rose and followed him. And now it happened, as he was dining in Levi's house, that many tax collectors and sinners sat together with Jesus and his disciples. And there were many, and they followed him. So here's this mixed group of worldly people. In that day, the tax collectors and the sinners, and they all sat together at house, and Christ sat in their midst, and he taught them, and he related to them, and they learned from him. It says, when the scribes and the Pharisees saw him eating with the tax collectors and the sinners, these worldly people, they said to his disciples, how is it that he eats and drinks with tax collectors and sinners? And when Jesus heard it, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I did not come to call the righteous, but the sinners to repentance. So within the church, we indeed have our own personal problems, and we're working on our personal problems. But it's outside of the church where our light actually shines the brightest, where the potential for our example is the greatest for it to be set. On one account in the Bible, Jesus actually refers to appear to the Gentiles, which I would say, would they not be strangers to Israel, the Gentiles? He appears to refer to Gentiles in kind of a disparaging way. And so again, you have this concept of, well, you're a stranger, and therefore you don't deserve what the rest of us get. But obviously, Christ was without sin. And I think when we read the whole context, we can see a contrast to his approach in that way. Matthew chapter 15. Matthew 15 and verse number 21. It says, Jesus went out from there, and he departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. Tyre and Sidon is over on the coast. It's outside of the Jewish community. It's outside of the extended Jewish community, even though there would have been traders there. It's a Gentile area. Why would Jesus Christ have traveled into a Gentile area with Gentile peoples outside of the bounds of Israel as we know them today? It says, behold, a woman of Canaan. Now we have a Canaanite. Obviously, a double whammy here. A stranger in a strange land. A woman of Canaan came from that region, cried out to him, said, have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed. He answered her not a word, and his disciples came and urged him, saying, send her away, for she cries after us. Some of the commentaries even say, well, it doesn't just mean only send her away, but it could even mean send her away, take care of her, and fix this problem so it will be over. So it could be either side, I couldn't say, but regardless, send her away, she cries after us. And he answers, says, I wasn't sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Were the lost sheep of the house of Israel Canaanites in Tyre and Sidon? I think not. And so the woman didn't actually qualify for what Christ's primary mission was going to be. Now the disciples later on were indeed sent out to the Gentiles, were they not? Were not the Gentiles brought into the church and became spiritual Israel? For Christ said, that is not my immediate focus. And she came and worshipped him and said, Lord, help me. And he answered and said, it's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. And again, it seems to be a very disparaging comment. But we know that Christ was without sin. Christ here would appear to be using this example as an object lesson, as a chance to teach. She said, true Lord, even the little dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered and said, O woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire. He actually tested her faith to see if she had enough belief for that prayer to be answered. And the daughter was healed from that very hour. Now, if you go back, what was Christ doing over on the coast? My guess, frankly, is he was trying to take a break. He was constantly besieged with people's needs. And everywhere he went, he was recognized. And there were moments when he simply had to go and be a little bit more to himself. And he was trying to get apart, I would assume, from where his labors were principally focused. And this woman came up and said, Master, I want you to intervene now for me. And it was almost like God, Christ said, it's really not my responsibility at this time. And she said, please. He said, okay. She was a stranger in a strange land, and Christ intervened on her behalf. If you go on down now in verse 29, you're going to see that that was something that Christ did on a much broader scale. Think of this in terms of interceding on behalf of a stranger. Verse 29, Jesus departed from there, skirted the Sea of Galilee, and went up on the mountain and sat down. And great multitudes came to him, having with them those who were lame, blind, mute, maimed, and many others. And they laid them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. Bunch of Jews, right? A bunch of the Israelites came up and assembled at his feet so that he could heal them. not so. So the multitude marveled when they saw the mute speaking, the maimed made whole, the lame walking, the blind seeing. It says they glorified the God of Israel. They're looking from the outside in. It was the God of Israel. It was the God of the Jews. It was the God of someone else, and they glorified that God because of the example that had been set, because of the miraculous intervention that they had realized. It's pretty and remarkable. What shows right here is that while his message was to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, ultimately, that he was going to train and teach the disciples to go out and then preach as well to the Gentiles, but it shows that he was healing and interceding on behalf of strangers all along the way. They glorified the God of Israel. Christ had great compassion on the people that he was in contact with, and it went beyond preaching the gospel. We can say, my gift to you is the gospel message. I will pray about it. I will contribute towards it. I will sacrifice in order that the gospel message can go out. Where does it say he preached to them anything at all? It just says he healed them. He healed the mute, and he healed the maimed, and he healed the blind. It doesn't say he taught them, in this case, in any way. There are organizations that go out and build hospitals and build orphanages and do many things, and we can say, fine, we have not the money or the resources to dedicate to those types of things. But does that mean that we have no money and no resource? Does that mean we have no time? Does that mean we really aren't concerned about the world's problems because we can't solve them anyway? You know, I'm very conscious of the fact that we can't solve the world's problems when I'm in Nigeria. Does that mean that we can't stop and give a gift to the beggar who is on the street? That we can't stop and show compassion to someone who is in specific need? Out of our abundance, out of the abundance of our time, and we all can say we have none, out of the abundance of our time, out of the abundance of our blessings, out of the abundance of the wisdom that God has given us, because that Holy Spirit that Terry was talking about is working in our mind, because we understand. It's pretty remarkable. Just go back to Matthew 14, verse number 13 in this case. Here you see, again, Jesus Christ needing some time, needing to be off by himself. He's tired. He's got to be. This is right before, well, I don't know what the time break is between the chapters, but verse 13, Matthew 14. We have here death of John the Baptist, the account. It says, when Jesus heard it, he departed from there by boat to a deserted place by himself to deal with the loss of a great servant of God, one of the greatest. When the multitudes heard it, they followed him on foot from the cities. And when Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude. And I would say all he really wanted was just for a moment at least to be alone. But he was moved with compassion for them, and he healed their sick. Set aside his immediate needs, and he began to care for strangers. And when it was evening, his disciples came to him, saying, this is a deserted place. The hour is already late. Send the multitudes away, that they may go into the villages and buy themselves food. Jesus said to them, they do not need to go away. You give them something to eat. You care for these strangers. And they said to him, well, we have only 5 loaves and 2 fish. He said, bring them here to me. He commanded the multitudes to sit down on the grass. He took the 5 loaves and 2 fish, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and broke and gave the loaves to the disciples, and the disciples gave to the multitude. They ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of fragments that remained. And now those who had eaten were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. And where does it say that Jesus Christ preached a sermon in any way? It doesn't even include it in the account. The whole account would appear to be that he needed some time alone. The people imposed themselves on him. He had compassion, and he fed them physical food. He fed a stranger. 5,000 of them. Maybe he knew a few. I think the example should be instructive. He still needs some time. Verse 22, immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up to the mountain by himself to continue on what it was that he had started, to pray. When evening had come, he was there alone. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves. The wind was contrary. So there's a storm blowing up on the sea there, and the disciples are out in the boat, and Jesus Christ is on the hill praying. It says, in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. Fourth watch. The Jews had three watches. The night is 6 to 6. The daytime is 6 to 6. Three watches of the night are 4 hours each. The Romans had four watches, and they would be four watches of 3 hours each. So we're talking somewhere between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. Jesus Christ now walks out on the sea. The only time that he had alone was the time that he should have been asleep. That was all he could barter, and only part of that. But it said he went up there to pray. And when the strangers imposed themselves on him, he tried to take care of their needs. When the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It's a ghost," and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them. He said, "I am so tired. What in the world is your problem?" He said, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it's you, command me to come out to you on the water." He said, "Come." When Peter came out to the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Christ stretched out his hand, Jesus stretched out his hand, caught him, and said, "Oh, you have little faith, why did you doubt?" When they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Yes, he's the Son of God because he had the power of God, but he also had compassion. He had compassion on a stranger and on the disciples as well. He had compassion on Peter. He didn't say, "You'll never be a servant in this church. I'll never be able to get you ready to do what God has given you to do." He just said, "Why did you doubt?" We have very close and personal and warm and loving ties in the church. We can go anywhere, usually throughout this country and in the neighboring countries if we chose. We could go overseas and we would find warm and ready friendships. We can go to Nigeria and be warmly and lovingly and well received. But we must not limit our compassion and our association to the church. We are indeed a light on a hill. At Ambassador College, when I was a student, we were encouraged to involve ourselves in some way, some type of community service. It was part of what we were encouraged to do. The students on the Sabbaths would often go into some of the nursing homes in the local communities and simply get to know people and visit them and encourage them in that way. Those who could sing could get together, a little choral group, and they could go and sing and entertain some of the people. But there was a contribution that we were to make. When I lived in Pasadena, and there were floods, and there were always floods because the houses are built up in the canyons and they've cut off all the trees and the forage, and when it rains hard, like it's done recently after the fires, the mud would slide down the hills. Numerous times I remember church members getting together, groups, to go out and to help people clean up in their homes, simply helping strangers. It's something that we were encouraged to strive to try to do. Over the years, I think my focus has pretty much narrowed to the church. And I've had to weigh that. And it's a hard balance. Will I neglect some of what I have to do in the church to help a stranger? You know, from time to time, I would have to say probably the answer should be yes. In some ways, probably the answer should be yes. Michelle used to volunteer in the school system when Megan and Derek were in school. She started out with her classes and walked right through. But in the course of that, she ended up running different fairs and activities for the school as well, established various things that other people picked up and ran with later on. he took Megan, and she raised Megan in a sense with the horse, because Michelle had more responsibility with Megan directly. With the horse, I was, you know, praying and fasting. But Megan would take her horse, and Michelle would haul her to the grade schools where the special needs classes were, because Michelle was helping with special needs as well then. And Megan would, you know, show the gear and the tack, and the kids would come up and pet, and she'd explain about the horse, and they just loved it. And it was something that we tried to build into to her that way, to make some kind of service to the community that provides and cares for us in various ways. And Derek was in Civil Air Patrol. Michelle and I went in, both of us again, Michelle first. I always followed, because she would say, well, come on, I need some help. They need help. You're not doing anything anyway. But we both volunteered for the Civil Air Patrol, and Michelle worked in the office and kind of ran everything and kept the books. And I began to teach moral leadership. It was a class they had, and so I would give a class. It was a little Bible study, so to speak. And I thought, well, I can do that. That suits me. I can contribute. I taught moral leadership. Michelle worked in the office. One day we're reading the newspaper. There's an article in it about a nudist camp north of Spokane, and the individual who's promoting the camp was one of the officers of Civil Air Patrol, one of the adult officers in charge of parts of the program. And we were stunned, because he was openly addressed. It wasn't some, you know, wasn't his eyes blocked out. You know, they just had him there, who he was, and it was a promotion for that kind of program. And we couldn't believe that here's a man working with the young people in the Civil Air Patrol, and we were working with him as well. So finally, after a time, Derek tired of the program. All he wanted to do was fly planes and do bombing runs and stuff, you know, but he flew a few times, but he eventually tired of the program, and he decided he was going to quit. We allowed that. It was his choice to start. It was his choice to quit. Michelle and I were still working, though, within the system to try to contribute, but the point came when finally this issue of one of the officers being an openly avowed nudist and promoting the camp, we just couldn't hardly abide that. Michelle went to her supervisor and mentioned it, and do you know who the supervisor thought the problem then really was? He thought it was Michelle who was strange. And I went to my supervisor and explained it, and the man basically shrugged his shoulders and said, well, nothing I can do about that. So, you know, in that case, Michelle and I then turned and walked out the door as well. We had tried to contribute. We had done what we could, but frankly, it wasn't a workable situation in that way. It won't always be easy to find an appropriate way to contribute, but there are still needs to be met. Yes, I can go to Nigeria and I could say, if I give you money, I certainly won't be able to give the next one money, and you know that may be true. But if I help one, maybe I don't have to help them all. Maybe I don't have to solve the world's problems, but maybe I do have to have the compassion to try to solve a few, or at least to contribute toward a solution for some. In the church, we do have a special responsibility to each other, but we have responsibilities to others as well. Look at Romans chapter 9. Let not our focus be simply limited to the church. Christ's wasn't. I thank God that those who influenced me so that I could be called, I thank God that their focus wasn't limited as well. I used to be a stranger. Now I believe. Romans 12, verse number 9. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. My title in the New King James says to behave like a Christian. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. When he says to one another, I think he's speaking to the church. This is the letter, again, to the church. In honor, giving preference to one another, not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. So the first part of the passage talks about good general Christian traits, but it also talks specifically about how those are played out in the church. Verse 17. Repay no one evil for evil. I certainly hope the evil is not coming from inside the church. I would assume the evil is coming from a stranger. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. So now we're clearly outside the boundaries of our congregation, all men. And if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men, even in the world. Isn't it amazing? You decide, I'm not going to sue my neighbor, and 10 years later, you're living next to him again. What if you'd have walked out the door and cut his throat on the way? You deserve it. You didn't treat me in the way you should. I'll get you for that. Derek bought a part for his car off the internet, paid through for his part through eBay. Cost a little chunk of change. It wasn't really cheap. The part came through the mail, and it wasn't the part that had been described. It was a part for another car completely than what Derek was purchasing for, and yet it was the picture that was on the little sale. You know, that's a hard one to swallow when you go back and the man says, well, I sent you what I pictured. No, but you didn't send me what you said it was. And the picture doesn't exactly show clearly one versus the other. And the man says, well, you got what the picture showed. Tough luck. Now, he didn't say tough luck, but he meant it because he's never refunded the money. He's never returned it. You can complain about it. You can complain to eBay. You can sit there and think and argue or talk to him or reason with him. And the fact is, he's got your money and you got his junk. Now, what are you going to do about it? Well, if you have recourse and it's proper, you take it. And if you don't, then you just have one more implement to place next to the plastic deer out in the yard. You got one more piece of junk to display. You get over it and you go on with your life. It's not worth being sick. You deal with it, and you go on. And you know what? You can't afford to hate even a stranger, because the damage will be with inside the self. Live peaceably as much as it is within you with all men. All men. Even those who take advantage or despitefully use you. As much as depends on you. Galatians 6, verse number 6. It says, let him who is taught the word share in all good things with him who teaches. Okay, we're talking financially here. Support those who have dedicated their lives to teaching. Make sure that they're able to continue. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. He who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And let us not grow weary while doing good. And it doesn't say just within the church. It doesn't say that. For in due season we will reap if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all. It says, especially to those who are of the household of faith. Especially. Because we have a special relationship. But not just only them. It says, as we have opportunity, do good to all. And you know what it's talking about? It says, it goes back here and it says, let him who is taught the word share in all good things to him who teaches. So it might mean, indeed, even a financial contribution or support to someone outside of the household of faith who has specific need. It might include that as well. Acts chapter 10 is one of the fine examples in this regard of someone who is loyal and faithful to God, using his Spirit, but trying to do good to all. Acts chapter 10, verse 1. There was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian regiment, a devout man, one who feared God with all his household, and he gave alms generously to the people. and he prayed to God always. He gave alms generously to the people. Some of those people, maybe most of those people, were strangers. There were some interesting comments in the Media and Communication Services update that came out, maybe it was even back a week or so. We read some of that. I know Perry was reading from it in Post Falls, and he asked if there's any copies back on the table, and I hadn't placed them there yet, so they've been placed out since. But in the Media and Communication Services update, there's a section of what is happening in media. And then it's from Larry Salyer, and they had a discussion, and some of the comments that were made were then laid out, and he copies them onto his notes, and then he explains them to kind of give us a bird's eye view of what was being discussed. And one of the first comments was, you know, we have the greatest message in the world. We have the message that God is working with all men to salvation, just each in their own time. We have the greatest message in the world. But it follows up that as an organization, we are phenomenally self-absorbed. We see it from our viewpoint, and we're so used to it that maybe we don't even see just how valuable and how unique it is. We're phenomenally self-absorbed. We talk about ABC and YOU and going to the feast. And a person could be standing there next to us and wouldn't even know, have a clue. And we love our fellowship, and we should. And we rejoice at being together, and that is a wonderful thing. But we must not limit our association, our example, and our contributions to the church. It is the world that we are to stay in a right way, but just not take the values to ourselves, so that our light is shined, so that our salt truly is a savor. I thought that was an incredible statement. We are phenomenally, sometimes, self-absorbed, buried within our own perspective. There is another announcement that was made about the new website and the church news program. And it says, I'm happy to announce, this is from Mr. Kylo, that we're launching two new tools that will improve our ability to communicate to the entire church. First, we're launching a new website specifically for members of the United Church of God because, frankly, the other website, ucg.org, was almost specifically for the membership of the United Church of God. It wasn't really designed for the general public. It had all of our doctrinal papers on there and all of our information and all of our church meetings and activities on there, and that's not what the general public is all about. And so they have now taken and they're separating the personal information that is of great interest to you and I, and the activity schedules, and the personal studies that are more applicable to us, and they're moving them over to a website, members.ucg.org, and they're opening up the main site for first contact information with the church, so that when someone goes in there, it is dedicated to them. Sometimes we are incredibly self-absorbed. I wouldn't have even thought of having done this. I'm too absorbed with myself in the church. We've been organizationally around since 1995. It's 2007. And we finally decided, you know what? We're going to have to design the website so that it actually portrays us in the way the world would want to see and hear and connect and maybe follow up and contact us in that way. I think it's a remarkably good idea. I'm glad somebody finally stepped back and looked around and thought of these things. So second, the main feature of this members site will be a regular online News of the Work video entitled About Our Father's Business. Walked in the door today, some of the members right here have already seen About Our Father's Business. I saw a clip on it last week. I went out, they took and filmed the various senior pastors that were in for our meetings in Cincinnati, and they're already showing those clips on the TV. I called up last night. I was talking to Mike and Joyce Imes, and Joyce has got, you know, the kids out, and they've got this set up, and their kids are watching the video as well to see what's going on in the church. It's a remarkable thing. So there are things, yes, that we need to do for ourselves. It's important. But we also need to be able to step outside of that and maintain a proper kind of relationship and contact out into the world to reach those people whom we can, whom God would move in their mind. We had our activity meeting last week after church up in Post Falls, And we went through and we laid out all the activities for a whole year. We do it once a year. 2 weeks later, we do the budget. And we lay out all the hall rental costs and everything we're going to have 2 weeks later. But we went through and we laid out the sports program and the volleyball and the basketball and the ski weekend that's coming up and the picnics and with the backpacking and the trip to Silverwood. Or I guess this year we're going to Silverwood instead of backpacking. They rotate every year. But we lay out a whole year's worth of activities and all the things we wanted. It was exciting to have seminars this year. We had World News and Prophecy. Then we had ABC presentation. And the brethren wanted another seminar of some kind brought in. And we discussed that. And it was all exciting. And we laid it out. After the meeting, somebody came up and mentioned to me, he said, well, what about trying to do something for somebody else? This is all for us. This is all our wish list of, well, I want to do this, and we want to have this for our kids. Well, that's good. We want to do those things. He said, what about trying to do something for someone else? And I thought, what an incredible concept to try to be a light to the world. So we're going to have to go and look at what might be available to us and try to build some of that into our activity schedule as well. We need to look at our lives, brethren, and see where it is that we might best be able to serve. But let's not limit that to the church. Let's stop and take a look around and see if there isn't some way that we can contribute to a stranger. The way that Christ did. The way that he taught the church to. So that we will truly and more fully do things the way we have been taught.